This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Melissa Idris and Tan Chung Han. Han is the newest member of The Morning Run team, and I'm going to be saying that consistently. I have been saying that kind of consistently throughout this week.
And for that, I thank you very much.
Okay.
Good morning, all.
Yeah.
At what point do we...
Stop.
Do we just assume that
Well, it's 7:15,
actually. Uh-huh. No, but through how many days? So this is day six now?
Well, day six on the job, day three on it.
All right,
yeah.
Fantastic.
I think there also there's a question of what listeners are picking up, and if they're saying to us, you know, who's that new person in the lineup, and that new voice I've never heard
unfamiliar
here before.
Unfamiliar voice. Who's the dulcet tones? Is it the one?
Dulcet tones.
No,
it wouldn't reply to Han.
No, though. Okay.
Well, I definitely want to make this absolutely clear. That title solely belongs to you, Melissa.
Oh, nice.
I won't even go there.
Sweet talker.
Yeah. Sent so early in the morning.
I know, right?
Okay. It is Friday, and it is the 13th of January, so that makes it Friday the 13th.
Are you superstitious about things like that?
I'm not generally superstitious, but and I've never associated with anything except the movies. So for me, it's got no power over me.
I try not to be superstitious, but the day before yesterday, out of nowhere, a black cat crossed my path. Like literally, this cat just came out of nowhere.
Was it cute?
No, I was just stunned because I was walking to my car and suddenly there was this cat that ran across my foot. And I was thinking, oh boy, that can't be good. And I'm not superstitious.
Really?
But then I was thinking, where did that cat come from and where did it go after that?
And where did that idea come from? Because it's not a particularly Asian thing, right? The black cat thing, is it?
Yeah, well, at least for the Asian context, you know, 13 doesn't really have that much of an ominous meaning. But when you look at the elevators, every time you step in, what's up to the 13th floor? 13A.
I am 13A. I live on the level.
Well, what about 3A? I mean,
right.
That's 4, right? So 4 seems to be a much more.
So yeah, so I think 4 has a, you know, like I think we as Malaysians should be more concerned if Friday fell on the 4th, you know, than the 13th, you know.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So, but I must say, I think I do have superstitions. I mean, I think when, say, for instance, you say something about somebody and you say touch wood,
that
seems to be something I do occasionally,
don't tempt fate.
And it's often about the death of a loved one or something like that. You know, you don't want to when you say something.
That.
Yeah, you can't joke about those things.
But I do have one story where I did this project, and you know how you're not supposed to break glass indoors.
Really? I've never heard of that.
Really? Like, you don't open umbrellas, okay? You don't walk under a ladder, and you don't break glass. You just don't break glass.
Well, that's just generally good practice.
Well, that was what I was told growing up. Maybe someone lied to me. I don't know.
Break mirrors or what?
Yeah, I mean, just mirrors or glass?
Glass in
general. And so I did this for this project. We lost. So, there you go.
Can I tell you, growing up, my grandmother told me that it's pantang to eat chicken wings. Young girls or young girls shouldn't eat chicken wings.
Why?
And you survive.
For my whole life, I grew up not eating chicken wings, although I loved it. And then later, she told me when I was much older, she said, well, I only told you guys that because I love chicken wings. So by telling you guys that it's superstitious to eat it, that was more chicken wings for me.
Yeah, well, that's like a conflict of interest right there. But look, if somebody tells me not to eat chicken wings, I'm like, there's no more reason to go on, you know? Like, it's chicken wings.
You know, there's a wonderful singer called Joan Armatrading. I don't know if you heard of. She's a British singer. She's and she had a song. One of her hit songs was, you know, I Don't Walk Under Ladders or something like that. Great singer from the 80s who's now, believe it or not, 66 years old. I can't believe it. Joan Armatrading. Maybe one of these days we could play it. I don't know. Do we have Joan Armatrading on our playlist? We'll find out. But before that, let's just look at the lineup that we have today. Melissa, you're on the grill this morning with Lim Han Ji, CEO of KIP REIT.
Yeah, they're en route for listing on the main market.
Is the REIT en route?
So, oh, very nice. A wheat en route. Very clever.
I know, it's going to be the podcast title, isn't it?
I just had a light bulb moment. Anyway.
No, actually, I had the light bulb moment and you just saw the... Opportunity.
It shone on you.
My light bulb shone on you.
Can also. So Mr. Lim Han Gee, he's the CEO of Kepong Industrial Park Real Estate Investment Trust, or short form KIP REIT. Now, they are en route for listing on the main market of Bursa Malaysia on February 6th. And they're going to be the first REIT listing this year. So I guess that the kind of questions would be to look at timing, why they've opted to IPO right now, and also to look at the assets under their portfolios. So I think they're more of a pure play REIT. They are pure-play retail REIT, that is. So they're looking at mini-marts and kind of hypermarkets.
Okay, for us, the uninitiated, could you tell us what a REIT is?
Oh, I thought I did. Kepong Industrial Park Real Estate Investment Trust.
Okay, so REIT is a real estate investment trust. Okay.
Yeah, when it comes to this particular asset class, the name of the game is it's a good way, generally speaking, for dividend yields. You know? So you invest into these and you get these kind of dividends, right? So I believe in the case of KIP REIT, they aim to offer a bit of a premium when it comes to the dividend higher than the market.
Yeah.
Right, higher than the industry average. And I was speaking to an analyst yesterday about this particular one, although her official report will not come out till closer to the IPO. And she's saying one of the reasons for that is because of the relative unattractiveness of their portfolio, because they're not concentrated in this high growth area of the Klang Valley. It's in Johor,
Melaka. So if you think about retail REITs, you think about Pavilion REIT or KLCC Stapled REIT or right. IGB REIT with Mid Valley. Those are like big high traffic malls, right? But KIP is focusing more on like a hypermarket / wet market, community market type. Mm. And targeting the lower income. So I'm really quite curious to know how they see the future growth of this REIT. I mean, do they purely intend to be a mart REIT? You know, it's a different kind of asset portfolio that they're embarking upon.
And you buy it like you would a stock.
Yeah, it's going to be listed on the Bursa February 6th.
Yeah.
So mark your calendars.
Wow, that's going to be interesting. We don't often have... how often do we have people coming on whose companies are going to be listed IPO?
Quite often,
because that's what BFM is all about. IPOs. Okay, after the breakfast grill, which ends around 8:30 and followed by the bulletin, we have current affairs. And today we take a look at Selangor's decision to ban plastic bags 7 days out of the week, which is pretty much every day of the week. And this, you know, of course, is a bold move in terms of getting people to change their habits with regard to plastic bags. What do you guys feel about this? I mean, there's some criticism that says that if, in fact, you know, the government doesn't stop people from being able to purchase bags, that if you can still buy bags from the supermarket, then nothing will really change.
That's right. That 20 cent price tag isn't exactly prohibitive now, is it? But I think ultimately the idea is to alter consumer behavior. I know for myself, given the last couple of weeks that this ban has been in place, you know, it really does cut back on the kind of leisurely or impulse shopping that I can do, because I do not have that extra or my designated grocery bag now that I have with me, you know. So having to make that 20 cent purchase, you know, is it prohibitive? Not enough.
So some of the detractors to this policy say it was quite a radical move, because why do it every day? Why a complete ban? Why not, you know, do what was implemented the first Saturday or every Saturday of the month? So you kind of ease people in. But again, I think, you know, if you don't do anything drastic, then you won't change the way people behave.
But didn't they already ease people
right.
in? Haven't we had a year more of this easing people
yeah,
in?
Yeah, so do you feel that the complete ban as a drastic move?
Well, perhaps this may be another easing, you know, another phase in this whole step, because I would assume that 20 cent thing may not be around for, you know, for an extended period of time. And because ultimately, if your goal is to completely ban plastic bags, it's got to be more than 20 cents.
Okay, I mean, but the question that can be asked is, why are we targeting plastic bags? We have all kinds of plastics in our lives.
Styrofoam, why
the plastic bag? How come it's now the pariah of plastic?
Well, it's so
which
much.
Is, which we is another
so
podcast title, by the way.
Pariah plastic. Just the sheer quantity, right? We use so many bags, sometimes for things that we don't even need. I don't know why it is that, you know, when we travel overseas, we can carry a green bag and put all our shopping in there, and yet here we don't, right?
So. Well, I don't know. I use plastic bags when I go overseas. I mean, wherever that may be.
So uncle are you. But and here's the other thing, that another fallout effect from this move here. I mean, I would think that you guys would have the that staple in Asian homes where you got that big chunk of plastic bags that, you know, you stash away in your kitchens.
You use it to trash your trash. Or do you use black plastic bags?
But then you seem to have an excessive amount of it, though. So that staple in Asian households may now be under threat.
The bag that carries all the bags.
That's right.
It contains all the bags.
Plastic bags.
I still have it on paper bags. One big paper bag that put all the extra paper bags.
Okay. That's so good. So thank you so much for sharing those intimate details of your lives.
That's a condition, though, Maisa, isn't it?
Everyone has one. Come on. Every household has one in Malaysia.
And speaking of houses, today, of course, is the property show day with Azur Rahman. And Melissa, you join her.
Yes, I do.
And for a news roundup of January. Was there much news in January? There's only been January.
Some really kind of important news came out this past few weeks. If you remember the Highland Towers sale, that's been the land surrounding Highland Towers, I think 15 plots of land, the bungalow lots, as well as certain a Highland Tower unit is up for sale. Once again, I think it's the second time in 4 years, AmBank is putting it up for sale. And Azura and I kind of go through some of the issues surrounding that piece of land, the property prices there. Look, if you put the stigma aside of it having the Highland Towers tragedy associated with it, it's prime land. It's prime location. So Azura Rahman and I will take a look at that piece of news later.
But is that classic perception versus fundamentals now, isn't it? So it's not just confined to this plot of land. I think it's investments as a whole. I mean, look at the ringgit, right? The local government and the local Ministry of Finance would say that, oh, this is just a matter of perception. You know, our fundamentals are strong. But then if you look at it from the perspective of foreign investors, they're saying, no, we're going to go with our gut feelings and forget about your GDP growth of 4.5%. So yeah, perception versus fundamentals, certainly an interesting theme to look out for during Melissa's talk.
And, you know, also the question
Also
the question of superstition, right? Because the events now are receding dramatically into history. I mean, it's been more than 20 years since the Highland Towers tragedy. Speaking of tragedy, the death of two people emerged in the news feed this morning. Bronski Beat keyboardist Larry Steinbecker, who died at the age of 56, and former England manager Graham Taylor, dying at the age of 72. For those who weren't fully sentient and conscious beings in the 80s, Bronski Beat was a very important part of the lives of people who listened to English music at that point in time.
I was quite young when he passed away, wasn't he?
56. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that how you pronounce his name? Steinbecker?
I believe, according to an interview on YouTube, it's Steinbecek.
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 Okay.
Larry Steinbecek. And the group Bronski Beat, I believe, carries the last name of one of its members, Steve Bronski.
Yeah, because Jimmy Somerville.
That sound. I love that synthetic pop 80s sound. I love it.
And we're going to play some of it for you later on. Also, just very quickly, a look at what's happening globally. Rising tensions between global power players, China, America, Russia. Rex Tillerson, who is Donald Trump's soon to be the president of the United States of America, his nominee for Secretary of State, says that he would deny China access to the facilities that it's built in the South China Sea. I mean, this is going to be a massive move if they actually enact it. It means, you know, Chinese, American warships blockading those islands.
Right. During the Obama administration, you know, the kind of counter moves to what China is doing in the South China Sea would be to certainly ramp up their rhetoric, asking China to play by the same international rules that everyone else is. And they even had patrols in that area, with the U.S. saying that, look, these are international maritime waters. We can sail through this, you know, as a role, given our status as the global superpower. But if this were to go through, it's certainly taking that whole engagement with China to a whole new level.
And also on the European-Russian front, we know over the last decade or so, you know, America has been forming alliances with various former Eastern or Central European nations and helping them. Now we have news of American tanks and troops in Poland, and Vladimir Putin, president of the Russian Federation, has come out to say that he views this move by America as a threat to his country's national interests. And that is an ongoing, I think, theme for the last decade, how, you know, America has pushed up right to the border of Russia and aligned itself with particular administrations there.
Yeah, in fact, I recall during Mitt Romney's campaign run, when he was vying for the White House, he did highlight that the biggest geopolitical threat would actually come from Russia. Now, granted, that rhetoric had died down since Obama then began his second term. But then now we're seeing quite the opposite, though, whereby there are these allegations that Trump is buddies with Russia. So it'd be interesting to see if, come January 20th, and the presence of those U.S. soldiers in Poland actually dwindle. What would that say?
We don't know, and we're going to be watching that space. But right now, we take a short break, and we'll be right back. BFM 89.9. Run continues, and that was Small Town Boy by Bronski Beat, including Jimmy Somerville, I think, who went on to have a solo career, and then, of course,
Steve Bronski
and Larry, the man who just passed away, Larry Steinbeck. Steinbeck.
But okay. I just love that. That's exactly the synth pop sound that I was talking about. I almost broke out the leg warmers and shoulder pads just listening to that song.
You see, that's interesting. Some people really don't like that synthetic sound, and then some people really love it. I mean, you know, and I think the world can be divided into the people who really go for industrial, you know, kind of house music type stuff.
Yeah, I know this is radio. You can't see my face, but I was totally cringing
when Melissa was making those.
What kind of music do you like, Han?
Well, I kind of like acoustic folk pop kind of thing.
The kind of solid stuff.
Yeah, it's more natural, it's more real. You know? Okay, as opposed to synthetic.
Okay, just in case you don't recognize that voice, that's Tan Chun Han, the newest member of the Morning Run team. And of course, Melissa Idris and myself, Sherrod Kutin. The big story, of course, internationally is the story of those allegations against Donald Trump that really, you know, have rocked the kind of prelude to the inauguration of the man now going to be sitting in the probably the most powerful political seat in the world. What do you make of it, guys? Because it's been a couple of days now since the allegations come out. Do you think it was wrong for, and continues to be wrong for, media outlets to be promoting the story or running this story because the allegations are not proven?
I think we have to make the distinction between the different media outlets. So BuzzFeed News published the whole 35-page document, whereas CNN and I believe Mother Jones and Newsweek had printed some parts of it, so maybe a two pages out of the 35 parts they say they could verify. Now, CNN says that they would not publish the whole thing because their team, their journalists, could not independently verify the facts within the entire dossier. But can I just repeat what BuzzFeed said? So BuzzFeed News came out with a statement that said BuzzFeed is publishing the full document so that Americans can make up their own minds about allegations about the president-elect that have circulated at the highest levels of U.S. government.
But, you know, can a document help people, you know, verify or make up their own minds? I mean, what would it be for a document to land in your doorstep?
Right. Firstly, this is a 35-page document. I don't know about you, but I would be hard pressed to find the time to scan through a 35-page document and then have a formulated opinion on it. That's firstly. I mean, secondly, these documents are being exposed at a time when media consumers are just bombarded with information. So it's not just a one-off 35-page document. It's a 35-page document plus our Twitter feeds, our Facebook feeds, and all these media sources that are just feeding us all this information. So again, the processing that's required usually, at least from the average media consumer standpoint, would have to be on the shoulders of the media outlet.
So you're saying, Han, that you think that BuzzFeed is being disingenuous, that this is really not... they're being idealistic.
Yeah, okay. You know, like, to assume that, you know, people, by publishing this 35-page document, that people would have the time or even the initiative or the will to even go through the entire thing.
Well, I see it differently. I don't think they're being disingenuous or idealistic. I think they're being downright irresponsible. It is the job of a journalist to verify facts before you report it.
But at the same time, if I may draw upon drawing upon my experience in other news outlets, both here and abroad, generally speaking, if you can attribute it to a source, and that's pretty much good enough. That source may remain anonymous, you know. And in this case, I believe BuzzFeed was saying that this document was widely circulated among governments and media circles, right?
Yeah. So I think that's what's interesting, right? What is the status of the document itself? I mean, is it enough to say that what is true is that MI6, a former MI6 agent, was commissioned to write this report initially by a Republican funder who wasn't in support of Trump as a nominee. Later on, when Trump did become the nominee, he dropped it, and then somebody else sponsored this. But the point is, that's a fact. We know that this happened. Is that enough of a basis to have this report put out?
Well, okay, so the journalist who was behind, who was instrumental in publishing Edward Snowden's leaks about the about government surveillance, Glenn Greenwald, he took a look at these documents and he said, I'm not going to publish it. As much as I want to expose wrongdoing in the highest levels of government, he says, and I'm going to quote him here, an anonymous person claiming to be an ex-British intel agent and working with a Democratic opposition researcher had made claims that anonymous people told him things. So how do you first verify the claims that were made by the people who are anonymous by the agent who claims to be an
agent?
Okay,
very quickly, I mean, it seems there's one point in the story that could be verified. A hotel, the bookings of a hotel, I mean, that could be verified. If the hotel does in fact one exist, two, Obama and Michelle did stay in the room that subsequently Donald Trump booked. And I mean, surely that could be verified.
Yeah, but we also have to be fair to BuzzFeed in a statement that followed after they released that document. They also admitted that the claims, the allegations in that document were not able to be independently verified by
the
reporter.
Disclaimer.
Yeah, they had that disclaimer.
Okay,
disclaimer is good enough?
Well, one comment that BuzzFeed made that I think is worth discussing is, as part of their statement, they said, publishing this document was not an easy or simple call, and many people will disagree with our choice. But publishing this dossier reflects how we see the job of reporters in 2017.
But we also have to be cognizant of the fact that news organizations now are under so much more pressure to be a business first and then a news reporting agency second, because especially in this age whereby, again, we are just bombarded with so many instant sources of news, it is so much more important for news organizations to be first. And we often see this mistake happening, right? First, get the news out there first and then verify it later, as long as you're first.
But do you think, I mean, this is sort of changing tracks a little bit, but do you think Donald Trump deserves it? After all, this is the man who inaugurated the age of, you know, the post-truth age. I mean, he has made so many untrue statements himself and doesn't seem to care about truth as such. Is it just the chickens coming home to roost, very quickly, to roost in his backyard?
No, I don't think so. I know what the claims that he's done, you know, he's really stretched the the truth till it's wafer thin. But I don't think that, I think it's not about what Donald Trump deserves. It's really about the role of the news organization in the age of a post-truth era.
And his tweets make news. Welcome to News in 2017.
Okay, we'll be back. Coming up very soon is the first bulletin of the day with Lynn Mark. She's poised at the mic. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Drop the Pilot by Joan Armatrading. And you're listening to The Morning Run with Melissa Idris, Tan Chun Hang, and myself, Sharad Kutin, with you, taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning, Friday the 13th. Which is no reason to stay in bed, as unlucky as that may seem.
Now, do you do stuff to get rid of bad luck?
Always.
Like mandi bunga, like that, is it?
Yes, I think there's always some trick.
Was it like throw salt over your shoulder?
Or touch these, wood. I mean, what is touch wood?
Yeah,
essentially
right.
That,
it's all
isn't
these
it?
Superstitions.
Yeah, you know, you can prevent, you know, things from happening in the world by just touching wood.
Or just don't get out of bed at all on Friday the 13th. Right? Yeah. Stay in bed all day.
I kind of
listen
prefer
to
that,
the morning run.
I kind of prefer that method right there.
But what about if you get hungry? Wouldn't you have to get out of bed? What if somebody was trying to entice you with a dosa burger?
What's a dosa burger?
Well, okay, so dosa here is the way which you might say tose, which tose is also something we say in Malaysia, tose. And burger, of course, is, well, burger.
Well, and I did not know that dosa was a tose in Hindi?
I don't know, actually. Yeah. I think people in India do say that, whether it's north or south, east or west of India.
I would like to think it's the sinful burger, you know, using our Malaysian translation.
Because it's spelled D-O-S-A.
Dosa.
Burgers are, you know, kind of health sin.
Not according to my religion, man. Okay.
Your religion of, well, McDonald's.
fast food
religion. McDonald's apparently is trying to launch this idea. It's actually still, as I understand from the report, still at the idea stage that they're going to be introducing the dosa burger. I'm not quite sure what the dosa is. So is it that the dosa replaces the bread, your bun, basically?
Oh, I didn't think about that.
Yeah. So you think of a masala dosa or masala dosa, which would be a dosa stuffed with potatoes, mashed potatoes and peas and stuff. Right? That's what you can get here locally. So instead of that, you'd have the dosa stuffed with a burger patty.
How would that be different from a wrap, though? Like, won't the burger patty be wrapped in the... Well, dosa?
Yeah, but typically wraps are made from wheat flour, right? So, I mean, they're basically kind of a bready something or other. Dosa is made from rice flour. So, and there's another thing about dosa, I think, which is that it's not just a kind of a rice-based bread. It's also often slightly fermented, right? So they put things in it so that there is a taste. It's kind of on the sour side. So I'm not quite sure how they're going to be able to replicate this, whether this would work. So you have a meaty interior, with this kind of dosa exterior. Do you think it's going to work?
I don't know, but it sounds delicious, I have to say.
You've got to try it at least once.
6:42 in the morning.
Because you haven't had breakfast, that's why.
Okay, but I think the biggest story here is the assimilation of, these global very Western fast food joints to new markets like India, like China. I remember speaking to Starbucks many years ago, talking about their foray into China. And, Asians generally being more of a tea-drinking society as opposed to a coffee-drinking society, and how they've had to assimilate to local tastes.
But then the question is, why would you go to a McDonald's for something you can get at a local shop? I mean, you go to McDonald's precisely for what it's different, right? The fare that it provides you, especially as it links to a kind of global culture.
I don't know. I think that it's a variety, right? It's not like you say, I feel like, don't say today, I'm going to go to a fast food joint. It's more, while I'm here, what would suit my taste buds today? And they're just offering a kind of a variety of items.
And also recognizing that McDonald's in Malaysia is very different compared to McDonald's in the States. I remember when I first came back and people were just hanging out and watching football games at McDonald's here. And I was like, this is absurd, because in the States, McDonald's is just your cheap... I mean, you don't want to be seen at a McDonald's. You know, it's like, oh, you're being cheap today. You went and got a Happy Meal, you know, kind of thing. So it's a very, the incarnation of McDonald's here, it's somewhat more comfortable and it appeals
it's more
to
leisure.
Yeah, more leisure. So, you know, having, like Melissa said, having this wide array of menu items to cater to all your needs while you are here hanging out watching a football game at your leisure.
Yeah, so your friends want to meet up at McDonald's. What's on the menu that you would like, right?
Yeah. Okay. I buy that, Melissa. I buy the idea that it isn't about attracting people. It's about just giving them a range of options. And also, I think it twins with this idea that the place has become a kind of new hangout. And it's a modern hangout as opposed to where your parents would have hung out, right? The coffee shop or in this case, kind of Indian restaurant. But I wonder about this idea of, a taste and whether it's really necessary or is it just that any kind of, food establishment always needs to change its menu. They always have to be selling something new. There'll always be the classics and the staples, but you need to do something new. You have to change fashions. You had to be sound funky. I mean, what they've done is they've got a conversation going about McDonald's that, you know, they might not have, they didn't even have to pay for by doing something that was slightly controversial, something, you know, and this is, if nothing else, a great marketing, strategy. Say you're going to put something really weird on the menu and everybody's going to be talking about it.
Apparently Twitter was a buzz in India talking about this. People kind of weighing in on whether they think it will be tasty or giving their own ideas of what kind of sauces would be great.
And I'm sure you'll find better thosai or dosa outside of the McDonald's. I mean, no offense to McDonald's right there. And likewise, I'm sure you can find better chicken porridge outside of the McDonald's here, although McDonald's Malaysia would say otherwise. But again, it goes back to the notion of these huge corporations having to ride on this, you know, excessive consumerism culture that we have here, and it just we want the next thing, we want the latest thing, even if it means repackaging a classic, so be it. Sell it to the people, get them in our doors, and hey, money.
Hey, maybe they can an idea for McDonald's if they're listening is that maybe they can change the hotcakes to dosai. You know what
dosai
I mean?
Cakes?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a breakfast option.
This is another dimension to the controversy in India, is that some people aren't happy and they're saying, don't mess around with Indian cuisine. So, you know, and you see this kind of pushback also in countries where they have a very strong domestic or national culture. They're constantly see threats from, you know, foreign, invaders, cultural invaders, and they want to push back on it. And so, you know, and you think of countries like France, you know, that also has this very strong nationalistic feel. India is one of those countries too.
But at the same time, you know, we have seen in various local contexts whereby the local population have really taken ownership of the McDonald's brand. No longer do they see McDonald's just this Western company coming in and infiltrating our market. No, because they have been so ingrained into our, at least here in Malaysia, in the urban context, and there's a McDonald's everywhere, that they have taken ownership to it. So hence, when you have these recent controversies in the local space, for example, like the cakes or these halal controversies, they say, no, this is our space, this is our menu, and we have the right to demand, that you cater to our various tastes, and this includes the halal controversy. Yeah.
Do you think that's a valid point, Melissa?
Well,
they're taking ownership of the McDonald's brand.
I mean, look, think of brands that have become so Malaysian that people have forgotten that they're actually from elsewhere, like Bata. You know, everybody.
Actually, that's true. That's a good point.
So this, I believe, is a Czech Canadian origin.
Canadian? Oh,
yeah,
I'm
yeah.
Sure.
So I think he was a Czechoslovakian who moved to Canada. But the point is, Bata became a Malaysian brand.
It's so synonymous with school shoes at one point in time,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. I know the brand Bata, yeah, you don't even say school shoes anymore. So I'm going to get a pair of Bata.
You're
so,
right.
Yeah.
Chirad was founded by a man from Czech Republic, but it's now based in Switzerland.
Yeah, no, as opposed to if, let's say, local consumers do not care about them, and if, let's say, McDonald's do impose a new ruling or change their policy, then the consumers will go, so what? hence no controversy. So the fact that there have been controversies, there has been an outcry, implies, at least in my opinion, implies that they have taken ownership of the brand. So, hey, McDonald's.
As in consumers have taken ownership.
But, you know, but there's also a question of you in our space, right? And so messing around with our cuisine, I mean, suggests that, you know, people can even make those kind of claims. I think it's extraordinary when you consider that globally, things that we come to think of even as Asian, like chilies, don't even come from Asia. Chilies originated from South America, right? So the thing that we think of quintessentially Asian and part of the you know, the of Asian cuisine, you know, has traveled. I mean, they're vegetables that have traveled the globe and on and on and on. But, you know, we always kind of like try and own things. Like, you know, our constant tiffs with Indonesia, you know, claiming Singapore. That, you know, this is our song or this is our dance, and or Indonesians constantly, you know, attacking us or stealing their things and making claims to it.
A quick text message here, an anonymous text message, no name here. Malaysians have forgotten our culture. We love aping what is foreign. Those are just some of the comments coming in.
Well, see, that's an interesting response. And it's very similar to those who take the kind of cultural invasion perspective on things like cuisine and fast food and
Yeah, because, you know, you have to ask the question, what is inherently Malaysian? Because given our, you know, history, given our culture with so many foreign influences, you know, what, like chak kuih, for example, right? I've used this example before. You know, now with McDonald's introducing it as one of their breakfast items, you know, chak kuih. Melissa, have you heard of chak kuih before?
Yes, I have.
Thank you.
Because I love it.
Because
if you go to Spain, you'll get the same fried dough.
Oh, really?
That's a churro,
Yeah, it's the same thing.
And what is it?
No, it's not. It's about the same. It's about the same.
Yo, come on. Don't be dissing my chakwe now.
Okay.
I think this is cultural appropriation.
My hands are up. Rescue me. In fact, we're going to be listening to Rescue Me by Linda Ronstadt very soon before we come up to the news at 7 a.m. BFM 89.9.